Last week, we listened to The Disease of Being Human, How I Was Saved by Dr. Sarno. It was Michael Galinsky's TEDx that he did in North Carolina. I was so pumped to get back on with Michael to do a debrief of that. That's what today is all about, so let's take a listen. As always, I want to make sure that I thank the patrons of the podcast, patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. These are people that throw a few bucks in the tip jar to contribute to the show and keep it on the air for free. So thank you to Carolyn, Redfire Phoenix 25, Leslie, Justin, Mary, Teresa, Albert, Jeff, Julie, Deborah, Elise, Dominic, John, Jason, Irina, Tony, Michael, Christina, Julie, Brian, Sarah, Arnie, and Barb, thank you so much for continuing to support this podcast every single week, month, and year. I'm so grateful. The last time that Michael was on, we were talking about this during the podcast, 2,598 days ago, August 22nd, 2018, Michael Galinsky joined the podcast to talk about the making of All the Rage, Saved by Sarno. At that point in time, it had been out a little over a year, and now it's been out over eight years. But I was really interested in this TEDx that he did. And at the time when we did the interview, TEDx had actually unlisted it or put it as unlisted on YouTube. And it was a big thing because people couldn't find it. They couldn't watch it. They couldn't listen to it. And so I wanted to bring it to the podcast. Since there's been a little bit of a victory and now it is up for your consumption. So you can check it out in the show notes of this podcast. But I'm excited for you to hear Michael and I. Let's take a listen to Michael Galinsky and I as we break down The Disease of Being Human, How I Was Saved by Dr. Sarno. It has been a long time. I've had a lot of repeat people on this. There haven't been any movies per se that I would say were life changers for me. However, what age would I have been? I would have been 31 as a 31-year-old, in immense pain. This is in probably June of 2017, I rolled across this trailer for a documentary that I think was yet to be released at the time called All the Rage, and it completely sort of changed the trajectory of my belief in medicine. And as an athlete, pain is something that happens all the time. The guy who made the film, Michael Galinsky, is on the line. It's his second appearance, but it's been essentially a lifetime since you've been here. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Nice
Thank
to
you
have
for
you.
Having me.
So we were just talking, 2019 or 18, I think was the last time that you were on. And I got to tell you, I saw the film. So first of all, I paid for it to stream it. And then there was a screening in Seattle. I don't remember the venue, but I was so enthusiastic about it. I brought an old friend of mine. I brought a neighbor of mine. I brought my high school journalism teacher, who I don't know if I'd seen in the flesh in, at that point in time, it would have been 23 years. And then she owns a bunch of yoga studios, and she was in 100% on everything that was going on in that movie. So, for those of you that are somehow listening to this and have never heard of it, do you mind just giving a quick synopsis of what that documentary is?
Yeah. So All the Rage started in a very complicated way. 20 years before I even started thinking about making it. My father was a psychologist who had terrible neck and back pain. And finally, someone gave him Dr. Sarno's book in the early 80s, and he had a miraculous recovery. So he bought a whole box of these books. And my dad had an incredibly deep poverty mindset, but he bought a box of that book.
Yeah.
So he would always have it to give to somebody. And that just, poverty mindset, buying a whole box of something,
doesn't exist.
That means something. Yeah. And not at a discount, by the way. So that really stuck with me. Wow, this is meaningful to him. And about 10 years later, my brother needed that book by Dr. Sarno. He actually had read the book, but he thought it was bullshit and it didn't help him. And he had RSI, and a guy, one of the top RSI, you know, carpal tunnel,
yeah.
Had told him that he had to have part of his collarbone carved away to free the nerves in his neck.
Yeah.
And my dad went ballistic. He said, if you don't go see Dr. Sarno, I'm not going to talk to you again. A week later, my brother asked me for his car back. He'd given it to me because he couldn't drive.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I'm going to read this book. I read the book at that point. We were both around 20 something. And my back would go out once a year, maybe twice a year for a day or something. It was always like, oh, I pulled it. And within a day or two, I'd be up and running. But when I read it, I was like, oh, this makes so much sense.
Yeah.
I'm a people pleaser. I'm doing all this stuff to help other people. Yeah, I guess I do. It's frustrating sometimes. And then you bring that into your body because you don't feel like you have the right to say to someone, actually, I don't want to do that for you. But a part of you is enraged, right? All made sense to me. Banished it for 10 years. Then I had two kids, a house, a difficult documentary career. Boom, just crushed to the floor. And at the time I was reading the book, it just was not working because it was so deep and the problems were so deep. It didn't work.
Yeah.
I got carried into his office by my wife, and I'd love to say I walked out of there standing like, you know, a non-Neanderthal, but I did limp out of there. In a series of weeks, I was moving again and I was, you know, mostly better. And that's when I asked Dr. Sarno, hey, can we make a documentary about you? And he was like, yes. You know, because I'd gone to him partly because we'd had made him a documentary that was really frustrating. It wasn't getting out in the world we wanted in the way that we wanted. But he had seen it and he really liked it. So he said, yes, I'd love for you to make a documentary. The problem was, A, nobody wanted to hear from him within the structure of the normal world. So there were no grants that we could get. We couldn't figure out how to get patients to come to him because he wouldn't introduce us to patients because that wouldn't be right. And, he was a little expensive at the time. It was like $500 to go and he didn't take insurance. I didn't know anyone who had that. Yeah. You know, it was hard for us to figure out how to get someone to go. It was hard to talk about it because you'd say, you know, the pain might be emotional. And, you know, next thing you know, you're getting hit by a pocketbook, mm-hmm. right? You know, people did not want to hear it. And he didn't really want to be a character in a documentary. In order to be in a documentary, you kind of have to be a little bit naked. You have to be a little bit present, or there's no story.
And his temperament.
And that's not something he was interested in.
Yeah, when you had described a minute ago about you pitching the idea to him and him being okay with it, even just based on mm-hmm. his temperament and a lot of the videos that I've seen of him. And again, like I didn't know him personally. That doesn't sound like it's him. You know what I mean?
I don't think he understood what it meant because, like, at the time. We knew that The Divided Mind was about to come out.
Mm-hmm.
So I called him up and I said, when the book comes out, maybe we can film some book events. And he said, oh, it came out 3 months ago. I was kind of like, well, how, what? And so it kind of stalled. And I felt really frustrated because I felt a responsibility once I started. I didn't know what to do. But it had started when I had started working in a different documentary and it was just overwhelmed with the previous one and the work on this one. And I got crushed to the floor. When we finished that one 7 years later, and it was just an incredibly difficult process getting that into the world. It happened again. And that's when I hit the floor that time. I screamed, grab the camera, because I kind of knew in that moment that I had to be in it, not only to make the movie, but in order to heal.
Yeah.
So I had to go through that process. I had a camera was a mirror that was going to force me to actually deal with this bullshit once and for all.
So can you comment on, a big theme in the film, which, by the way, again, this just came to me, September 22nd, I bought a new phone last year. One of the things that was included mm-hmm. was 2 terabytes of storage through Google. And mm-hmm. we have a server set up in our house. Didn't want to pay for cable anymore. And I wanted to upload all my DVD movies. And mm-hmm. I'm trying to free up space and I'm moving things from the cloud and from my server onto my personal computer just to try and get enough to get under this threshold. The one thing that I cannot bring myself to take off the server for the moment until I find a solution mm-hmm. is All the Rage. And it's a 4 gig file. But I can't bring myself to just have it on my computer or just have it on my phone. So another weird, kudos to you on that. So self-imposed pressure in a lot of ways was sort of what got you to the floor to begin with. Then you pick up the camera, you decide, hey, I'm going to make this thing. However, this type of project is an enormous undertaking, whether it's about Dr. Sarno, or you're doing a documentary on cats in the wild, or like could be anything, but it's now you have something, you've committed to doing this project.
Yeah.
More self-imposed pressure. So I'm curious, as you're making the film, and maybe not, I know we see a lot of this stuff on camera, but I'm thinking like post-production, promotion, traveling, trying to get the word out, doing all that stuff. Can you talk about like your, any sort of physical pain that you had that continued through that, and / what sort of things did you do to combat those in the midst of like, you know, I know enough about this stuff to know what's going on. I know what the anecdote is. I'm literally promoting this thing and I'm having symptoms. I imagine you had to have something. Can you talk about that, the post-production?
Yeah. So absolutely. So even in the healing process and even in the movie, it's like, you know, people would say the first question at every screening was, are you better? And I would say, well, I have this disease. It's called being human.
Yeah.
It's always fatal, but right now it's largely in remission, you know, and it's true. You know, we're always going to have these things come up, but, and then there's the pressure to heal all the way. You know, if you're going to put that pressure on yourself, I will say that it has been a long, winding journey all the way to this moment where I'm sitting here. And I will say, I feel like I'm doing a little better all the time. Mm-hmm. If you look at it on a chart, it looks like the stock market. There's ups and downs, but it's always moving upwards in the long term.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, one of the biggest tools for me actually came a little bit after finishing the movie. I will say this, one of the interesting things, I'm going to backtrack a little bit to the very first screening we had was at a film festival in New York. And Dr. Sarno came. He was pretty ill at the time, but he was able to get there. He got a standing ovation. And after the standing ovation, the first question was actually a statement. And it was like, that was really brave of you to be so emotionally naked in the movie. And at the moment, I kind of laughed it off. And I said, yeah, it wasn't, you know, I mean, that's what, you know, kind of making art is, right? Yeah. Like, if you're not emotionally naked, then you're not really making art. You're making commercial art or yeah. whatever. But then when we actually released it, the first two reviews came out. The first one in New York was fairly positive, but the first line was, director, distance thyself. That's what you'll say when you watch this movie. And the LA Times headline was, director hijacks his own film. But the good news is, I completely understood. Oh, those are critics. Mm-hmm. Who becomes a critic, right? Someone who wants to look outward because they don't want to look inward, yeah. right? I get it. It's fine. And I was able to not take that personally, but the amount of kind of anger and angst and like agita at me being in a movie that was like this, it was kind of intense, but it was also very revealing. And that has continued throughout the process of trying to get this movie out in the world, because there's this incredible amount of animosity towards Dr. Sarno for not being scientific enough, for not doing randomized controlled trials. When in fact, he was coming from a very, very curious place of inquiry and looking at the data that existed. You know, like there's a lot of data and there was a lot of studies that were done well before the randomized controlled trial existed that talked Hans Selye with stress and everything that Freud talked about. You know, it had come out of vogue, but the basic idea about the repression of emotions impacting the way that we think and our physical body, we're proving that today yeah. through fMRI studies. So it's like we oftentimes take science and use it as a cudgel rather than a can opener. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really the problem here. But the reason I was going back to that idea of that question of healing was it was hard, but knowing that made it very, very possible to move through really quickly, to not be overwhelmed by it and to not even be angry at these people. And that fact that God, it must be so hard to be that critical because yeah. you know they absolutely fucking hate themselves.
Yeah.
Right? Like if you're that critical, you certainly don't love yourself very much.
Yeah.
You know.
Isn't that this isn't any type of a segue, but as you say that, I think about Larry David. I know he was in the mm-hmm. I know he was in mm-hmm. the, and then you mentioned him in TEDx, which we're gonna talk about in a minute. That's like a comedian thing too, right? Isn't it? Like
comedians are people pleasers.
Yeah.
I mean, why are they making you laugh?
Yeah.
They're making you laugh to distract from actually seeing them. I mean, a lot of times that's what why we become comedians, because we are trying to distract from the problems that are going on in our family.
Yeah.
Right? There's so much agita going on that, hey, let me relieve some of that right now.
My wife and I talk about this a bit. I know that your daughters, I think, when the movie was released, are about the same age that my kids are now. How old are your daughters now?
One is 23 and one is 20. Okay. 22, 20, like 2002 and 2006.
Okay. My kid.
Maybe, so one was in like third grade then, probably your second grade, and the other was in fifth grade.
Oh, okay. So yeah. So yeah. Audrey is in second grade, Zoe's in sixth grade. So yeah, that would make
yeah.
that makes
yeah,
sense.
Yeah, that's the same. Yeah.
Yeah, 3 years apart. One thing, particularly with our older one, is that a lot of time, I think that maybe this is just a general 11 or 12 year old girl thing, but feels very insecure in her own skin. And a lot of times I think the less confident she feels in a situation, the funnier that she tries to be.
Right.
And it really looks a little cringy. And so maybe that's a kind of what you're talking about with the comedian.
Yeah. Thing. Yeah. Right. It's about like bringing attention to themselves, but actually distracting from themselves.
Yeah. You know, this just came to me, but being a dad with a couple of daughters who have now, they've gone through teenhood, all the experience and the knowledge that you have gained, and, you know, this is different than a lot of times I ask these questions to like a psychotherapist, right? That they've kind of got the schooling behind upbringing of adolescence and all that kind of stuff. What has been like, can you talk about the knowledge that you've gained just in learning about Sarno and learning about TMS and learning about emotions and their role in pain and upbringing and, you know, the ACE studies and all that kind of stuff? How did that impact your fathering for two kids? And if this is too deep, tell me, but fathering of two kids, particularly girls going through teen years, tween years, all that kind of stuff.
Oh, you know, it's complicated. Yeah. I think, you know, it definitely made me a better father in some ways, but, you know, part of the problems that lead to that kind of pain probably makes you not the best father you can be.
Sure.
So it gets complicated. I will say what's interesting to me is that 3 years ago, I got a dog. I can hear her kind of snoring behind me. And I mean, it's going to circle back to what I was saying. I was going to say before, is like the two greatest teachers for me have been yoga, which I started in a crisis 6 years ago, and getting the dog.
Okay.
Because when you have a dog, you you want to be like, I had one other dog in my life, and it was amazing, but it was also really traumatic. Mm-hmm. He died in a very traumatic way with a stomach torsion, which I never really dealt with. Like when he was about 10 years old, stomach flipped and boom, you know, and it was hard. And, but when we got him, we didn't have kids yet. And we just basically saw his dad tied up outside of a bar. And we're like, oh my God, this dog's so beautiful. That was a Shepherd Rottweiler mix.
Yeah.
I think, or just a Rottweiler something mix. Anyway, he was beautiful. And the bartender came out, are you messing with my dog? And we're like, oh no, we just think he's beautiful. Well, I have a puppy. You want him? Maybe. And that was a Pitbull Rottweiler Chow mix.
Awesome.
So I guess he was a Chow and Rottweiler dad and a little Pitbull mom. Anyway, he was wild, never trained. We were young people and we thought dogs should be free. We were idiots.
Yeah.
But we did learn that we could keep an animal alive, and that led us to have children. But we were terrible at training. He had a lot of anxiety. So I got this puppy 3 years ago. A woman handed to me in a gallery opening. I was like, oh my God, can I hold your puppy? And she said, you can have her, because it was a foster.
Yeah.
In any case, I was like, great. And then when I took her home, I was like, oh, I have to really do this right.
Yeah.
But that was complicated, right? So I started looking into training, and I was doing it intentionally. But what I wasn't really doing was being cleanly communicating energetically. So for instance, she wouldn't leave the property at first. She was scared. And it was frustrating. So I'd be frustrated. Oh, I'm frustrated.
Yeah.
I'd get rid of the frustration. Then she would go.
Yeah.
So it was my energy. You can't hide that shit from a dog.
Yeah.
You can pretend you're not communicating that to your partner, but you're lying.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you haven't said it doesn't mean you're not energetically communicating. And so it makes you really, really check in with, that's there. And you really have to come back to center all the time, all the time, all the time. And it teaches you a lot. So it made me a much better parent, even though they were 20 at the time, right? Like, it just made me realize I have to be better. I have to apologize more. I have to be more present. I have to disrupt when I'm acting in ways that are inappropriate. And you really learn so much if you let your dog teach you how to be a better human.
I mean, yeah, dogs definitely have that, like, that intuition piece, because like, if you're, say that you're feeling shitty, you ate something bad or you have a bad cold or whatever, and you curl up on the couch, like, they're not leaving, you know, like, that's sort of what they are. So I totally, I'm in on that. I'm a dog person. If you did not know, we actually have a pit mix too. She's very sweet, but, okay. Now, as people are listening to this, last week on the podcast, I aired a now unlisted TEDx that you did in, let me try it one time and then you can correct me if I get this wrong. Catawba. Is that right?
Catawba.
Catawba.
Catawba, North Carolina.
Catawba, North Carolina. So you, I want you to go through the process of being asked to do a TEDx, which there's, it's even dripped itself into the way that some people talk. I could sit here on my soapbox and tell you all about the Seattle Mariners and why I think they're going to make the playoffs and they could be World Series champions. Then I might end that by saying, thank you for coming to my TED Talk. So you now have experience doing that.
Yeah.
I went to a Mariners game last week with Brad Gutting, who runs the TMS group with me. And a lot of you listening to this probably know who he is. He's from St. Louis. We watched the Mariners play the Cardinals. We started talking about you. We started talking about the TEDx, and then we go to search for it on YouTube. We can't find it. And then he goes and I think he's sending DMs to you and you're saying it's now unlisted. Take us through what's the deal with this TEDx that you did that people just listened to. Last week's podcast was literally just that. Run us through this whole thing. How'd you get involved? All that.
Well, you know, as I said at the beginning, before we started, my brother has done several TED Talks. Mm-hmm. Some of them have, you know, several million views. So he set up a TEDx conference at Columbia one time, and a woman who was the speaker coach for him was setting up the TEDx one in Catawba, which is not far from where I live in North Carolina. My brother was supposed to be a speaker, but he was moving to Singapore. So he asked me if I could do it. And at first, my wife and I were going to do it about all of our films, but that wasn't really a TED Talk. And then I realized, oh, I should really do it about Dr. Sarno. And so then I spent many months working on that. And it was hard because I'm actually doing a big project with the Savannah Bananas right now. And I just had no time to look at it. And finally, I like made some time and I kind of got it memorized. And then I went to do the run through. And like, think of the biggest ramp you could ever be on a skateboard.
Yeah.
I ate it in the middle. I like literally started doing the run through and I had all these slides and I got to the part where I talk about my father having an ulcer and I just broke down.
Yeah.
I mean, just bawling. I couldn't speak. So that night I went home and I had to take out all the slides because I thought they were going to be hitting them, but it just, and I rewrote the thing that night with my brother, trimmed it down a lot. And the next day I did it pretty well. I wish I could have done it better. I literally walked around the whole day trying to memorize it. I missed everybody else's talk, but I had to get it right. And I did have to say place, you know, and someone was reading along with the transcript and would, and redo it. Cause then they can edit it, right? They cut out those pauses. Anyway, that's how it came to be. And ultimately I was pretty happy with how it came out. Unfortunately, the TED people think that Dr. Sarno is a quack or that neuroplasticity isn't science. And they've just called it pseudoscience and won't, they agreed to put it up once I sent a bunch of footnotes, but they made it unlisted because they believe it's not scientific. Now, it's just like our movie though. If we made our movie where we just listed the facts about Dr. Sarno and we tried to make an argument about why he's right, A, no one's going to believe it because you're arguing with them. And as we made the movie, we started out, we had all this stuff and people would, we do a rough cut screening. People would say, it's good. I need a little more, just a little more proof. Could you show me that this is true? I want to see the science. So you put in more science and it sucked. Yeah. Nobody wanted to watch it. So then we took all that out and they're like, oh my God, it's so much better. What did you do? The same people were saying they needed more. So the point is, our lives are all stories. Mm-hmm. we're telling ourselves a story about ourselves all the time. And part of the Sarno problem is most of that story is bullshit and it's based on trauma.
Yep.
So we have to rewrite our stories. And when we do that, what we're learning now through the science is we're literally changing our brain. And we learn things like you have to do that for 30 days and the neural pathways are different. Think about if you see water coming down a, you know, a sandy mountainside, it's going to go where the root goes. It's the same with our brains. You tell your brain what to do and it does it. The problem is your brain doesn't have what has more agency than we think, but you can take that agency back. You can say, hey, brain, I want you to be aware that this pain in my arm, I don't need it because there's nothing broken. There's nothing wrong. I don't need your help right now.
Yeah.
Thank you. You know, and it works, but you have to do it. You have to believe it. Belief is everything because belief turns on the activity in your brain to do something. And if you don't believe it's going to work, guess what? It ain't going to turn on.
Yeah.
So you have to really lean into belief. And then people think, well, that's quackery. That's religion. I'm sorry, but it's true. And belief is science. Belief runs your brain. It does. If you believe I'm a shitty person, you're going to feel like a shitty person. If you believe you're a good person and you act in good ways, you will be a better person. You will treat people better, right? So if you're, if you feel like you're a shitty person, you're going to treat other people shitty.
I had Nicole Sachs on years ago, and she said something so similar to that where she was like, if I sit here and I grovel and I think I'm a piece of shit every day, then guess what? I'm a piece of shit. And that's really, now you mentioned religion a minute ago. There is possibly not a more non-religious person out there than the guy who hosts this podcast, me. But Larry David said it was the closest he ever had to a religious experience in your movie.
Right.
And I feel very much the same way about all of this stuff. Like an evangelist. And I try to not, I used to be very shout it from the rooftops, tell everybody all the time, whether they wanted to hear it or not. And now I've become such a recluse that like my neighbor two doors down had a party on Saturday, like a big block party. And he had, you know, it was 40 people there. And all he wants to talk about, especially when he drinks, which is a little annoying, cause I don't. And so I stop over there to say hi. Cause we were gone the whole day. We didn't go to it. He's introducing me to all these people and he's like, oh, he does this podcast and it's about this and it's about that. And I'm like, oh, well, tell me more about that. And I'm like, I do a podcast on psychology and I kind of leave it at that because some people think I'm nuts, right? Because of that stuff. And what's interesting, so a lot of the perspective that you had talked about in the movie with Sarno is that colleagues didn't believe him. He was sort of shunned out of the medical community. It seemed like, I mean, some of the shots of him just looking, maybe depressed isn't the right word, but like, God, I'm doing all of this work. I'm doing all of this good. Nobody believes me. You know, everybody thinks this is a total crock. Movie comes out in 2017. I thought it was phenomenal. The Boulder back pain study has come out. There's lots more books that are out with citations, with scientific research, with all this kind of stuff. And yet you still have the resistance of doing this phenomenal TED talk. And it's not believed to a point where it becomes unlisted. Like, I'm sorry, that sucks.
Well, so it does. But the good news is, it's not something that I'm going to embody.
Yeah.
Right. I'm not going to bring that into my body. I'm going to think. So what I'm actually doing is manifesting that it will actually get out. And, you know, my brother just sent a letter on my behalf to someone who works there saying, look, this is science. Here's the science. Dr. Clark wrote a nice letter.
Because he's done a couple of them. He's done a couple. They know who he is. Yeah.
He did a TED talk for TED people.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like literally at their office. He did a talk for them. So maybe that will help. But it's also like it's almost ludicrous at this point. They're going to end up looking like fools because there is science. They literally just decided, I'm not going to believe that science.
Yeah.
It's like willful blindness. I don't believe it. They're having the symptomatic me conference in 3 days. Like this stuff is shifting.
Yeah.
And if you go on, you know, the different grams or whatever, but like Instagram, all I get is trauma informed stuff. You know, you click on two things and all of a sudden it's the same. Like our brains are algorithms.
Yeah.
they feed us what they think we like. So if you click on a bunch of those, you get fed those ideas. If you tell your brain, we're thinking more positively now. We get up in the morning, we're starting new habits. That's another thing I've started recently. I get up in the morning. I certainly have some ADHD. I never made my bed. I started a habit. I get up, I make my goddamn bed. Yes. First thing.
Yeah.
Don't pick up my phone. Go drink a little bit of lemon juice. Dunk my face in ice water. And honestly, the first time I did it, I thought I was going to die. And I mean, it was just like so overwhelming emotionally and everything else. But, you know, here's the deal. What it does is if you do it the right way, put my hands on the counter, I keep myself relaxed despite the discomfort. Now it's actually really invigorating.
Mm-hmm.
Like I just got, we have a pool and it's a little bit chilly. And I got it. What I've been doing is getting the pool. This cold water feels so good. Because I used to be like, oh, it's so cold.
Yeah.
Now I go, this water feels so good. And guess what? It feels good.
Yeah.
Right? Like, your brain is only following what you tell it. And once you start to realize that, you gain an enormous amount of power over your own health. And people don't want to believe that. That's not religion. That's science.
Yeah.
So these new patterns have made me, and I also do like 5 somatic exercises every morning where I just, do the arm lifts, all this stuff. Get your body moving. My brain is clearer. I'm calmer. I'm less random thoughts buffeting me. So you can take steps. You can take action. And it's really important that you don't put pressure on yourself to take that action. You are grateful for the opportunity to do that action. It's not pushing too hard, because that's what I tended to do. It's pushing enough to get moving and then let it go from there. You know?
It kind of reminds me of the conversation I had to have with myself when I went from doing afternoon or evening workouts to I'm now the 6 a.m. guy. Like,
yeah,
it was difficult. However, my perspective on it is doing something, A, that's moving, and 2, that's not too challenging, but challenging first thing in the day. And I feel like that inherently kind of removes a little bit of burden from your shoulders. That's just how I feel. But it sounds like that, right? Like if you do it enough times in repetition, it doesn't even have to be a crazy amount of time. You mentioned 30 days on a couple of these things. Like I did find that kind of was a little hard for a month, but then after that, like it's just what I do. It's just part of it, you know?
Yeah. In fact, and if I don't do it, then I feel a little bit off.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to, it's hard, and it's hard to not be like, okay, there's nothing wrong. Today's not the day. Yeah. Or like I said, I've been doing these shoots, and last year they almost killed me. And I had a lot of like, my leg was really bothering me. I mean, it's hard. I'm walking around with a very heavy camera. I'm shooting for 12 hours and I'm also having to think of everything to shoot. So it's unbelievably exhausting. So 3 days of the shoots, I'm done for a week, at least last year. This year, I'm like, I shot literally 7 hours of footage on Saturday at Yankee Stadium. I was fine on Tuesday.
It's completely off topic from what we talked about. We're going to wrap here in a minute. I've got to know, because I'm obsessed.
Yeah.
If you can even talk about the Savannah Bananas project. My buddies and I, we do an annual motorcycle adventure somewhere. We went to Banff and Jasper in like central Alberta, Canada for our trip this year. One of my buddies brought up, what if next year we sort of center our trip around the Savannah Bananas and we find a place that they're playing on the West Coast, which I don't know if the schedule's, I don't think it's even out for when we're going to do
this. It's out October 5th, I think.
Okay. So then we can take a look. How did you get involved? What is this going to be? When can we expect it? Like,
we actually made a series for ESPN, their first tour.
Okay.
We made a short about them for SportsCenter before they even did their tour, and it blew up. And so that's how we ended up doing this series. And then we made another series the second year following them just by ourselves for their YouTube. And then we shot last year and this year, just knowing that like this, what's happening would happen.
Did your interest in doing this, is it more of a, you've liked baseball forever, or is it that allure and mystique of like this thing, it's they're selling out football stadiums. That doesn't really happen with baseball as a sport.
So what happened was, we have done a bunch of stuff for ESPN and they asked my partner, hey, do you want to go down to Savannah and do this short about this college summer league? They're getting a lot of heat, So he made that. He went down there and he shot that, and my partner cut it with him, and it just blew up. And that's when they said, hey, you should do this. So we pitched it. And I didn't know anything about it. I got down there the day before the tryouts, and I'm just, it almost killed me. Yeah. That was hard. I went 21 days straight shooting with a new camera. It was hard. But it was really exciting. And what they're doing was clearly something exciting and energizing. And so I just stuck with it, even though it was as hard, and it was very hard.
Yeah.
But the next year I was like, I'm not giving up on this, even though ESPN doesn't want to do a second season. I'm doing it.
Yeah.
So I just followed him myself.
That's awesome.
And I followed him myself last year, and I followed him myself this year. Yeah.
So the project that you just got done, like filming at Yankee Stadium, like when do we see that stuff?
It's probably going to be, well, a lot of it is going out in little bits, like, on, you know, shoot stuff and then we give it to Jesse. So the things you see with Jesse doing the speeches and stuff, it's mostly me shooting it.
Yeah.
We will probably make another series. We are working on a movie right now. We have an idea for like a movie, and I think it'll be as big as Jackass, right? Like it will be, there's so many people who want to see them. So many people who saw them.
Yeah.
If you take the 5 million people who saw them and who want to see them, then you've got a $50 million film at the box office.
I mean, I think they've already been to Seattle. I'm a season ticket holder for the Mariners, so I was able to get into the lottery for it and did not win the lottery. Could not get a ticket.
Well, I was thinking about that. Well, I'll help. It's this weekend. They're playing this weekend.
Okay.
In Seattle.
Okay.
So we'll talk afterwards.
Okay, cool. Michael, thank you for being here. It's lovely to have you on. Maybe we have you back not 7 years from now. Anything we didn't cover that's on the tip of your tongue?
Well, I'll just say this. These ideas are becoming more normalized. They're much easier for people to get. Now it's becoming the tipping point where I was like, well, of course. And I think it's a really exciting moment. And I guess the things I would say is, we think in individual ways, we think in our family ways, but we're also really deeply affected by our culture.
Yeah.
And in this moment of kind of frustration with the medical system, rather than seeing the medical system as the problem, what we can do is say, God, it must be really hard to be in that system. And I'm really thankful that they're moving in this direction. And if we all can move in this direction of understanding that our thoughts do impact our body and that we can change our thoughts, and it doesn't mean that we change who we are and our essential nature. In fact, those things that get in our way are usually just reactions to trauma.
Yeah.
And you don't have to go deep into the trauma. You can just say, this isn't serving me anymore. I'm going to try to start to shift into being able to listen without, I'm noticing when I'm reacting. Oh, that reaction. If we're having a reaction, it's about us.
Yeah.
Always. And owning that a little bit more and stop putting everything else on everybody else, because it's really like this circular triangulation where we're trying to make someone else responsible for how we feel when both things are true. They may be doing something inappropriate, but if we react inappropriately, we're not going to solve that problem.
Yeah.
We may have to separate from people who won't work with us. You know, we may have to change some of our lives, but we are all on a healing journey, even if we don't realize it. We're here to heal, and we can heal, and we will heal if we move in that direction. That's really the essential thing that people need to know. They may feel like as soon as you start telling somebody all of your symptoms, then you're really just distracting from what's the emotion behind it. Think about, what does that symptom mean in relation to what you're repressing? You don't have to go deep in. You just change the patterns.
Yeah.
And as we change the patterns, we start to heal ourselves.
Michael, thank you for being here. People want to find your work on social websites, things like that. Where can they find?
On Instagram, there isn't All the Rage page, but mostly I just post it. Rumor Picks is RUMUR PIX. We have a website, rumor.com. And alltheragedoc.com is where you can find everything about the movie and where to see it.
Michael, thanks for being here.
Thank you.